Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Trevor from Halifax calling in to say that I support Creative Control on Patreon because I think long-form arts journalism is a crucial part of music culture and there's simply not enough of it out there today. Vish is a master interviewer, he lands great guests, and he has his finger on the pulse of the ever-changing music landscape both here in Canada and abroad. For all of these reasons and many more, I think you should support Creative Control on Patreon too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I am Visha's wife, and I will love him no matter what you do. And now he has me on the record saying that.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Kate Beaton is a talented, award-winning cartoonist and writer based in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. Renowned for her hilarious and historical comic strip, Hark a Vagrant, her children's books like The Princess and the Pony, and the Apple TV series Pinecone and Pony, Beaton is an outspoken humorist who deals with the serious from an absurdist point of view. Her latest book is a memoir and a graphic novel called Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands, which captures Beaton's real-life attempt to pay down her student debt between 2005 and 2008, by leaving Nova Scotia for Alberta to work for the oil industry under isolating, grueling, and often traumatizing conditions for her and her fellow workers. Ducks is an astonishing and essential contribution to Canadian comics and for works of personal history, and it's available everywhere as of September 12th, 2022, via Drawn and Quarterly. Married to author and friend of the show, Morgan Murray, Kate and I connected recently for a nice chat about her birthday, her masterpiece Ducks, and what life was like living in different oil sands campsites in Fort McMurray, Alberta, as a young woman, how capitalism compels people to live in different parts of the world, even if they don't exactly really want to, student debt and the cost of living, when boomtown industries go bust, our complicity in propelling bleakness, mental health in the labor force and the Me Too movement, toxicity and community building, her signature pony and forthcoming projects, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, where you can get episodes of the show early and also access some exclusive content. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a well-stocked record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and friendly staff who will happily help you source special orders for hard-to-find releases, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 716 of Creative Control, featuring the ingeniously clever and talented Kate Beaton, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Kate. How you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
I'm fine, too. Thanks for asking.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on?
How are you doing today?
I'm not bad. Thank you for asking. I know. I was being sincere. It's nice to speak with you and have you on the show. Where in the world are you there, Kate?
I'm in my house in Mabo, Cape Breton. So I'm in the basement while my husband wrangles the children upstairs.
Lovely. How are things in that part of the world for you today? Was it a busy day?
A very busy day. It's my birthday. We went and we gave blood and we took the dog to the vet. It was just jam-packed.
Are you telling me that we're talking on your birthday?
Yes. Yeah, I am.
Okay. So I have a few things I want to say. First of all, happy birthday.
Thanks.
And secondly, I'm sorry I called you on your manners a few moments ago on your birthday. That was rude of me on so many levels. I was already rude, and then it feels even ruder.
I interrupt all the time, as you can see. So
yeah. No, I know it's a trait of your people out there in Cape Breton. I think maybe I don't know. The third thing I was going to say: why on earth are you doing interviews with the likes of me on your goddamn birthday? You should be doing other things, don't you think?
Well, we are going to enjoy a cake that my daughter picked out later, and it is pink and it has a cat on it, so I'm all set.
Okay, well, that's good. I really can't thank you enough for making time for me on your birthday. Is it a significant birthday, milestone birthday, or is it just one of the normal ones?
No, just a regular 39. So.
Oh, well, that, okay. That
In a sense.
Yeah, that is a milestone. That's the last one of those.
Yeah, depending on how much weight you give to that kind of departure.
Well, it's lovely to get to chat with you, as I've expressed to you and to your husband, previous guest on the show, Morgan, there. Big fan of yours, particularly in this house. Various generations have encountered your work and your books and stuff. Congratulations on this latest one. Ducks, I would like to ask you, for the benefit of myself and the listeners, in your own words, can you summarize what Ducks is all about?
Well, it is about the 2 years that I spent working in the oil sands of Fort McMurray between 2005 and 2008. But it's about a lot more than that. It's not just a recounting of events, but it's about everything that I have sort of carried with me since on my mind about things that I saw and the people that I met.
Yeah. Let me say this. It's a very beautifully looking, it's a graphic novel. Am I using these terms right? Sometimes
yeah,
I feel like I'm using the wrong words. It's a graphic novel, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it looks beautiful. It is harrowing and beautiful and infuriating and funny as hell. It's all the things I like. Well, I could do without the fury. I could do without the kind of hatred of all men. But that's the reality of the situation. No, it's really, how do you feel about it? Does this feel like a particularly ambitious crowning achievement type thing for you?
I don't know. It's been, I've been working on it for so long that it's very hard to gauge any particular thought about it that is, you know, the one, if that makes sense. I'm proud of it. I have worked for a long time and I worked hard on it. And I'm glad that it's going out there. And it's definitely, of course, it's different than anything else I've published. And I think it was the right time for me to make a change like that. I also felt very compelled to make it. So it was a book that that was very much in me to make.
Yeah. For those who, and I appreciate all that. I'm just holding here, Katie, I don't know if you've seen your own book. I'm just holding a copy up. To the camera. It's some, what is it, 400? I'm trying to go to the last page. 430 pages. Is that unusual in your realm? That's a long one, isn't it?
It's long. It's not unheard of. There are a lot of them that go that length. But I didn't want to make it overly long. I think that if it had been any longer than that, people would be throwing it out the window. They finish it
and killing people. They would be if they threw this out a window. Someone's going to get hurt. Yeah. It's a heavy.
Depending what story, for sure.
Yes, absolutely. Now, what compelled you to take this on? You said a few different interesting things to me there about why this has come to be in terms of you know, wanting to tell a story. It being a departure from other things you've done. Do you have a sense of why now? Why is this happening now in your life, do you reckon?
Well, it's happened over many years. So I started thinking about putting it together in 2014, probably, when I put up a series of sketches under the same title. And people responded well to them. So I thought, you know, maybe I could do something bigger. And I think I had always sort of thought that I would. But it seemed like a very far away project. And in 2014, it seemed like something that I could do. But I think I had to accrue the skills as a storyteller and as a comic artist to do justice to what I wanted to say. And I think I also needed the distance from the time that I spent there to think about what I really felt. So 2014 is only, 6 years after I left there, maybe? I don't know.
You said 2008, so yeah, that is correct. Yeah, it seems really okay. It seems really recent, actually. Yeah,
I know it feels recent, but now it's 2022, and so I get questions like this, like, why right now? And you're like, well, I started this a long time ago, so it's not really a question of right now. It's just sort of it was a long time coming.
Is that a clumsiness of language on my part? I guess what we're asking us rubes is, why is this out now? Not why did you start working on it when you did?
Well, you mean because people know me from Hark a Vagrant and stuff, and why didn't I keep doing that? Is that sort of
That's not where I'm coming from. I mean, here's where I'm coming from. Let me just tell you, okay. Having read the book, knowing the multifaceted emotional aspect of the book, where I'm coming from more is about why, after processing it for, it sounds like you did, 6 years, what compels you at that point to be like, I can't just live with this on my own. I need to kind of capture it, potentially for therapeutic reasons, but also in your case, artistic reasons, you know. That's where I'm coming from. The motivation at that point to do this. Why? Do you know why?
No, I think certain things are just on your mind. And when you do what I do for a living, a cartoonist, and you are drawing scenes from your life, it's sort of a natural thing. But I think I was waiting until I had the skills to do it. But who knows when that is. But there's also, you can't wait too long, because then you don't remember as much. Like, the further you get away from it, the less you recall. So you have to wait for that point where those two threads sort of intersect in, like, the now or never sort of way. And I think that's where I was at.
Given the, as I say, multi-layered emotions you must continuing to be going through, having had this experience, had you tried to address this experience in other ways? And where I don't want to pry, but I want people to know, I think, that we're getting into the realm of trauma. What else would there be? I think that's the main word.
Yeah, I guess that would be the word.
Well, I mean, it's certainly an aspect of it, but it's also, you call the thing ducks. And yes. I know why it's called ducks, because I've read the book. For those who want to put two and two together, it's about someone going to work in the oil sands region of Alberta. And also, I think not only dealing with, we should say out of necessity, right? Like, this is all real life stuff. You had to kind of, at the time you lived there, you had to do it.
That's what it felt like, yes.
Because of crippling student loan debt.
Yes, and because that was the pattern of labor in my home region. That is what people did.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a question of like, are there other choices? It was like, that was the choice. Yeah. I am from the Maritime Provinces of Canada, for your listeners, which is a place that has been exporting labor for multiple generations. It's very ingrained. It's understood the way things are, that you go to work where the work is. And that's good. And even though they were tossing around terms when I graduated from university, calling it things like money jail, you have to go to money jail. It really shows sort of how people thought about the necessity of leaving for that place.
Has that mindset changed, whether post-pandemic or for other reasons? Like, we're not talking about ancient history. I'm curious.
Well, of course, people move someplace, and it's not a monolith, right? A lot of people have moved there and made it their home and are very happy there. Especially, you saw a lot of people from my region living in Fort McMurray during the Fort McMurray fire. And so there were different stories, you know, Fort McMurray strong and all this stuff. Like, they're building their own communities out there. And they did the same thing in Ontario in the 70s and wherever else, like Cape Bretoners and Maritimers en masse have gone. Not everybody feels the same way, but there is always this underlying thread of homesickness too. And because of how people were compelled to leave. I don't know, many people totally shake that.
You've got the oppression of debt. You've got people, mostly, it seems to me anyway, mostly dudes with some relative happiness saying, yeah, my wife or my partner and my children are all the way across the country and I'm here toiling away and I miss them and all that sort of stuff. And women too. So you got capitalism, to me, is the underlying issue here. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair to say. And there's a number of issues, but they tie into capitalism for sure.
Yeah.
And a Canadian breed of it.
Canadian breed of it. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the thing there, Kate. I feel guilty because I live in Alberta, having been I'm from Ontario, and I found myself relating to the characters in your book on some level because we moved for more or less capitalistic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't afford to live in the real estate market in Ontario. Weren't getting jobs that we thought paid enough. Are we villains? Are we terrible people for doing this?
No. Everybody does what they need to do.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Like, I left the oil sands and I went into, I lived in Toronto, New York, different places, and I found different people with different judgments about the oil sands, which is fine. Everybody has their opinions. But as for the workers, you know, they're not like some kind of faceless mob who doesn't give a shit about the environment and just went out like gobbling money. People go where they need to go to support themselves, their families, whatever. You don't know people's choices for going somewhere that they need to economically. And like, no, everybody knows that in Canada, Ontario is the bad guy. So
Yeah, Ontario's not doing so well either. Yeah, we were also fleeing the kind of political climate, but for here, it didn't make no sense. Like, it's a weird thing to do. Yeah. And so you've lived according to your book, you briefly lived in Victoria, right?
I did, yeah.
So have you lived, by my reckoning or my count, you've lived in Cape Breton. You've lived in various parts of Alberta. You lived in Victoria. Did you live in Montreal as well?
No, never.
Never lived in Montreal. Anywhere else in Canada?
Yeah, I went to university in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Oh, right. Mount Allison.
Mm-hmm.
That's a nice, I like that town. Do you like that town?
Nice town. Yeah, very nice town. and right on the border to Nova Scotia. So it's very, it wasn't too far of a toss.
Yeah.
To get me there. But it was interesting living in a different province for a little while. I lived in Newfoundland for a little while when I met my husband. I lived there for 8 months. So
oh, nice.
I don't know if that counts.
It does.
I lived 6 months for somewhere to have residency. So I lived there for 8 months.
Yeah.
And yeah, different places that I have lived. Very pan-Canadian existence.
I only ask because I wonder if it gives you perspective or further perspective on your time in Alberta. Like, has living in different parts of Canada given you perspective on where to live in this country? I know where you are, and that obviously might inform your answer. You've chosen to be close to your home base, I guess, right? Your origin place.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like you, when I lived in Toronto, I was faced with the mounting pressures of cost of living there. And even since, I keep up with sort of the unkindness of the city's response to unhoused people and things like that. You see, I think, when you've lived in a lot of different places, what you're in tune to or what you are interested in. And I've always been class conscious, I think. So that felt notable in Toronto, where like it should have been a city that felt better than it was, if that makes sense. By the time I left there in like 2015.
Yeah.
So they weren't at the point where they are now, where there's like demonstrations that I see about like the like tent cities and stuff.
Yeah.
But it felt like things were sort of tipping into like a crisis point for housing. And that felt very harsh for the city that should have been like the biggest and the most accessible in many ways because of that. And when I lived in Victoria, I had just come from Fort McMurray, of course. And I lived from the East Coast, and Victoria was so beautiful, but it also was a very moneyed city.
Yeah.
So you couldn't help but notice how it dealt with issues of people on the street with like addiction problems and stuff, which I put a little bit in the book because it's so high contrast. It's for a lot of people outside of the oil industry and everything, it's very easy to like condemn certain things. But then you look around and every city has got its own issues with various cruelties, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I didn't really have like a grander point in the book because these issues are so gigantic. Like how could I ever sum it up? But I think being raised on the East Coast and moving into like the mainland and all of that has always made me sort of class aware.
There's a striking scene in Ducks where a group of younger workers at Fort Mac. I think they're in Fort Mac. I don't know this area well enough myself. Most of the action is based in Fort McMurray. Is that correct?
Mostly, yes.
You're kind of moving.
Yeah, in and around Fort McMurray. I work for different companies.
Yeah, you're moving around into different camps and stuff like that, but in the region of Fort Mac, right?
Yes.
And just before I get to my point, how would you characterize Fort McMurray generally?
At the time that I was there, because I can't speak for it now,
of course.
And that's an important, that's an important distinction to make because some people read the book and say, I'm sure they will say, well, this isn't what it's like. And I don't know what it's like right now. I'm writing about 2005 to 2008.
Fair enough.
But when I was there, it was booming. It was absolutely booming.
Yeah.
And like in 2008, oil hit the highest price it ever hit, nearly $150 a barrel. And to give you, an opposite of that, during the pandemic, it was worth less than zero.
Right.
So, it seemed like the sky was the limit and people were just pouring in and they couldn't build fast enough. And renting a room cost, like for the first few months there, I made no money because it cost so much to rent a place. So I was making more money than I had ever made in my life, but I was also spending it all on my cost of living.
Yeah.
And that's why the jobs in the camps were so sought after, because you didn't have to pay rent.
Yes.
And you didn't have to pay for food. And both of those things were like expensive. So it was just booming, and it comes with all of the things that a boomtown has.
Yep.
Good and bad, the promise and young families, lots of young families coming in. You said mostly men, but lots of women were there.
Yeah.
They might not have worked where I worked, but they were there. And they lived in the town, a lot of them, and they had young children. This was a place for hopeful people to come. Lots of immigrants.
Yeah.
Lots of immigrants coming to Fort McMurray. And so like far more multicultural than my book is able to show, because my book, it's very much around me and my circle that I'm with, which was very small and white. And because everybody was getting jobs through people that they knew and stuff like that. And so I was like mostly being around the same sort of groups of people from out east. And so it sort of gives the appearance of like a sort of a middle-aged white world almost. But it wasn't in the town itself, very multicultural.
I appreciate that distinction. And I didn't mean, I'm focused on the book and the sites because it is pretty monoculture-y,
totally.
If you will. I mean, there are moments where I can think of two people of color, one of whom is someone who seems to be identifying as a female worker, like not a welder, but she does something where you're surprised that that's the work she does. I can't remember what it is.
Welding.
Welding. Okay. Sorry. I don't have any notes. Yeah, I'm just riffing off the top of my head.
No, and that's okay. She's a welder.
And then there's a fellow who might be of Middle Eastern descent, maybe.
In the office.
Yeah. And he's a bit odd, but anyway.
Yeah. He's an odd duck.
Yeah. So you got, yeah. So all I'm saying is I'm drawing my impression from your book. Primarily.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as much as I would have liked to add, more characters or something that you would have known, then it would have been fiction too, right?
Yeah.
I would have been making that up. So I couldn't. But it's a regret as far as telling like something that is, representative. But I have to say from the start, this is my experience.
Here. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I really hope that other people put out more books about it, because there aren't, if there's an interest in it, and I think there isn't enough.
Yeah.
And anyway, so like I was saying, the town, it was booming, all the stuff going on, both good and bad. When you have like an influx of like a lot of young transient workers, they're unmoored from society. They are they're making maybe lots of money. They're foolish. And like there's lots of availability of things like drugs and alcohol, other vices and stuff. So of course you get all these the names that you get with these kinds of towns, like the kind of Wild West stuff. And you have a clash between, I think, the wildness and the people trying to make it a great place to live.
Yeah, and one of the clashes that I was trying to get to there is there's a scene in the action of the story where there's a group of younger, I think they're all younger people, and they're talking about what they're going to do with their money, and they're going to buy this thing, and they're going to buy this motorbike or whatever it is. I think they're all talking about it, and then one of the older
boys' toys,
but then one of they get admonished by one of the older guys. It's like, what do you do? And I think they're all from away. So
all from Newfoundland.
They're all from Newfoundland. And I think this fella who admonishes them, as I recall, might actually be a local. And he just loses.
He's from Newfoundland.
Oh, he's also from Newfoundland. That's even better then.
Yeah.
So he's admonishing them. And I think some measure of capitalism by saying, what are you talking about? What are you doing? Throw all your money away. Like, it's one of the few scenes, because I feel like I almost want to say your character, Kate, you in the story, I think are just constantly going through this existential angst about what the hell, what am I doing here? What are we doing? What are we all doing as a society? That's one of the few moments I can think of where someone else in the story is like, don't you know what we're doing here? why we're doing this,
yeah.
why we all moved here. I found that to be very striking. And I feel like that's a common thread to me in this book is like, why are we doing these things in terms of capitalism and consumption? Is that a fair point to raise? Do you think that's part of what you're
getting? It's fair. Yeah. It's fair. And to me, a lot like that was some generational discord almost. But like you had older generations of, say, fishermen who lost everything during the cod moratorium in Newfoundland. And they were coming there after making nothing all their lives. And maybe they were making good money now, but they were cautious about the money that they were making because they knew what it was like to have everything taken out from under your feet.
Yes.
And they were working side by side with these younger guys who came out there and they were making six figures the moment they turned 19.
Yes.
And like somebody that young who also grew up with, you know, probably fairly little, making that kind of money, no one has any sense about it. Of course, it seemed like at the time that this was going to keep on going and going. And like, why not spend my money on this stuff? And people would just spend.
Yeah.
And they didn't have like the kind of longer view of life yet. They were just young guys spending money because they never knew any different than making as much as that coming out there. Where these older generations, like they had lived through making nothing and losing everything.
Yeah.
And so they'd watch them and be like, what are you doing? Like, what are you doing? Spending like buying like a skidoo and a four wheeler and like another brand new truck and your gigantic house and all this stuff. And it's not like, you know, there was constant fights about it. It's just that every now and then you would see a little bit of that kind of divide in thinking. And as somebody who was making no money compared to any of them, because mechanics made way more money than I did. And I was giving all my money to the government. So I would just sort of be very observant of these things. Because I had no horse in either race.
Right. Yeah. And so I can appreciate that in pondering this and reflecting it in your work, it seems to me that you're making some sort of critique of this kind of behavior. But I also of this sort of level of consumption, and by including the scene that I was alluding to of an elder, if you will, saying, what are you kids doing? Like, think about this. And you being like, yeah, look at me in this. You're in the scene, as I recall. Is that the scene where the panel is you just looking over the newspaper at this action? Is that one? I can't recall.
No, that's
is that later? One. Okay. I feel like there's another explosive scene and you're just like, whoa.
There is. That's when everybody's taking a shit on Alberta. These guys working from out east, because they were always, not always, but like quite a few of them would be like, you know, I hate this dump and like,
oh, that's the, oh, sucks. Yeah, right.
And all this stuff. And, you know, you'd be talking shit about being in Alberta and always, you know, missing home and blah, blah, blah. But there was a lot of guys out there from Alberta and they were hearing it all the time. And they were like, shut the hell up. Like,
that's
this
right.
is my home.
Right.
You came here. Like, right. you come here and all you do is whine about how much you miss the East Coast, but you don't mind making the money, do you? Like, you, if you don't like it, like, leave. And they would just be annoyed with that, what that kind of like, boo-hoo talk.
Yes. I think I've conflated the two scenes. Yeah. I see where I've gone wrong. Yeah. I apologize. So you're
that's okay.
obviously reflecting this dialogue and maybe asking readers to maybe ponder that dynamic.
Dynamics. I'm choosing to put him. Yeah. Yeah. I'm choosing it, but I'm like, if it seems like I'm taking one side over the other, it's not really, because I was the younger generation. I just wasn't making any money. But I feel like there was a lot of people who had, when like the bottom fell out of oil and like things busted and jobs were lost or Fort McMurray went on fire, there were different people who were like, this is hubris for your, you know.
Yes. Schadenfreude, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, people were losing their houses and it happened over here too. At that point, you lose your job and you can't make the payments on your truck anymore and all this stuff. And you can be like, you did this to yourself. And you know, it's true, but also like they were just young guys. They didn't have, when you grow up without money and then you start making it and you don't know how to manage it, like you just don't know. it's not like someone comes and like knocks sense into your head. Maybe that old guy did but it didn't seem like he was getting through to them, did it? So
no, I think that within the action of the book, there are little sort of small indictments of this kind of behavior. But where I'm coming from is trying to figure out how you feel you're conveying the complicity of the actual industry in all of you being in this circumstance in the first place and the environmental impacts. There are scenes where various women are talking about these bizarre, yourself included, rashes on their backs, you know, being in this environmental this situation where ecological damage is being wrought. But you're all kind of, all of us are complicit in it. Would you say that's at least, if not a subtextual thread, part of what you're getting to?
No, it is. It is. And we are. But like, you also have to, like, coming from Cape Breton, a lot of people, I feel, don't recall this, but the largest toxic waste site in North America was in Cape Breton until very recently.
Right.
It was the Sydney Tar Pons. And that was not off on the side or anywhere. It was like right in downtown Sydney. And it was the runoff from Sydney Steel, which was the one of the biggest employers in town, right? And when Sydney Steel closed, like a bunch of people lost their jobs and their livelihood and everything like that. And so people getting cancer, and like it was like a crazy boondoggle to clean it up, to try and clean it up, and a political like garbage dumpster fire to do it, and people were getting sick, and you're growing up with like on an island with the largest toxic waste site, and you're like, well, this is how businesses run, and you go somewhere and it's toxic and shitty, and you're not surprised, you know. Yeah. It's not like my hometown is very nice and pretty and everything like that, but it's not like I left like a bucolic field of sheep and went to the, you know, with like the gulls flying over the boats, and then went to like the oil sands where I was just like, oh, we're destroying the environment, but I don't care. I grew up on an island where workers were treated like shit, and by people running an industry like stealing coal and everything that was never really meant to thrive it was never really run in good faith by anybody.
Yeah.
And it didn't matter when it all shut down, like in the larger scheme of things. Like when you read about the closure of like Cape Breton Industries, it's always like summed up being like, well, it was a big waste of money, so good riddance.
Yeah.
Never minding that like people's families and stuff were torn apart by everything, and that it was like, if you were in Sydney around that time or on the island at all, like it was dire.
Yeah.
It was a very bad place to be. And meanwhile, like, you're making this gigantic toxic site here on Cape Breton and everything, and you're well aware of like the cost of running these businesses. And I grew up with like Westray happened not like only a couple hours from where I grew up, where workers went into the ground knowing that it could blow up because of the coal dust that was lying around. And you have quotes from them being like, I just hope it doesn't happen on my shift.
Right.
Because it's going to explode. And nobody ever went to jail for it. And nobody, like the owner of the company, Clifford Frame, he never even showed up to testify at the trial. Because he was like, this is pointless. And that's what we're used to. And what coal mining is not like environmentally friendly. It's not, you know, you're digging a big ass hole in the ground and it's not known for its like care for the environment. So we're over here, we're living with this like duality of like the tourist image of like of people thrown back to a simpler time.
Right.
You know, back on their farms and their fishing boats and stuff. And these like sort of like dirty industrial working people and conditions and the Going Down the Road guys, if you remember that movie by Don Shabib, if I have the name right.
Yeah.
And you bring all that baggage with you to a place like Fort McMurray. And so you already know the companies can do whatever they want because they're not going to go to jail and they're going to treat you like garbage and no one gives a shit.
Yeah.
And what they do is fuck up the land around them. And, you know, you are lucky to have a job. So it takes a while. It took me a while to come around to my complicitness in it, for sure. Yeah. Because, of course, I chose to go there. Everybody was going and I chose to go there. And it's not like I was like some helpless like stooge or something, but I was moved by forces like economic, regional, migration, different things. And by the way that we treat workers and the land here already before even going to Alberta.
Yeah.
And that's a really long sort of convoluted answer to me.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't at all. There's a lot to say about it and it's hard to get at all of it. I mean, on an artistic level, if I recall correctly, there are at least four locations that I can think of. Well, maybe there's more. There's Cape Breton. There's the Fort McMurray area. You have a little break in Victoria, BC. And I think eventually end up in, there's a scene at least in Halifax. Is that about right? Am I missing anywhere?
Yeah. No, yeah, that's it.
So artistically, if you ponder this, did you kind of try to draw these places distinctively from one another? Like in terms of, you know, in my admittedly rudimentary knowledge of, I've been reading comic books a long time. And I know that colors and shading and all those sorts of things will contribute to mood and whatnot in terms of what the author or the illustrator are trying to convey. Were you conscious of making sure that these locations and the scenarios were presented in particular ways?
Maybe not in the way you're thinking. I think I just drew what I drew.
I figured you might say this. I think you have. Do you feel like you? Because I was reading here. I have this too. I was reading last night. I was rereading Hark a Vagrant, which I'm holding up to Katie for those of.
Oh.
I was looking at that, and you seem to have a. I feel like you treat your illustration and your interest in comics and all these sorts of things. I feel like you treat your craft with a little bit of. I don't know if it's bemusement. Like you can't believe you're doing it sometimes, or
oh, yeah.
I'm not going to take this that. Sure. I can't take this that seriously. Like Hark a Vagrant, I was laughing out loud. At the book yesterday, and I didn't do that. There's a couple of moments in Tux, but I mostly was a couple of moments, but I was mostly like, oh, this is very heavy. Anyway, where I was coming from is, it seems to me that I'm maybe being a little hoity-toity about art and your motivations. You're saying you didn't think about it too much.
No, when I was drawing it, it was really like I drew it through two pregnancies, and I'm having a baby, and having the babies around, and it was very much like, oh, I got to get this done.
Yeah,
I got to get this done.
Okay, so it wasn't like,
but not to say that I didn't think about what I drew, but I wasn't like, now that we're in Victoria, let's mute the palette or something. Things look different because they're in different places. Like everything in the Fort McMurray pages, like they're heavy industrial looking places. They look markedly different than a scene where I'm bicycling around Victoria.
Yeah, they seem more drab. And I mean, if I think on some of the Victoria panels, they are pretty dense. There's a lot of like architecture, and it's not like they're wide open. There is a heaviness to the drab. The drabness of the Fort Mac stuff comes across quite a bit, is where I'm coming from. But that's just what it was, right?
Yeah, well, I worked on two of those camps were just mines that were under construction.
Right.
So they weren't even, they were just like you're living in trailers out in the woods while like these like mine sites are being constructed around you and going or half operating or whatever. And and so like the earth around is all dug up and there's no grass and there's no, like the trees are sort of like in the distance. And they're thin. I read a thing from some anecdotes from Cree elders saying that like the trees look sicker than they used to, things like that. And I don't know if you, I feel like you could tell that with some of them.
Yeah.
And there was a sense of what was going on in the, and like environmentally around it. And it just like, just a lot of, you know, dirt. It's the mine.
Yeah, no, and that comes across. I didn't mean to draw too fine a line. No pun intended.
Oh no, that's okay.
No pun intended. I will tell you that usually when I talk to like a musician or a comedian, I feel like I know their realm a bit, and I can sort of just like. But yours is it's so foreign to me on one hand that someone would be like, I'm going to tell a chunk of my life story in a 430-page graphic novel. I don't talk to many people who do that. So forgive me if my questions are a little pedestrian or something.
No, don't worry about it. And you know what? I'm going to be really like in my head tonight about answering that question about economic stuff on the East Coast because it's so complicated.
Yeah, and that's fine. We're not experts. We're just people trying to process stuff that's going on. Earlier, we were talking about the why now questions you might be getting about ducks coming out. And I wonder if you can ponder this. So a good chunk of the book, to me, seems to be about loneliness, isolation, forced exile, rampant misogyny, horrible people on some level. I feel like we're still in a pandemic. I think a lot of that stuff in our lives, those modes, those feelings, those horrific aspects of human nature, lack of decorum and morality, some of that has been heightened in the last couple of years. I'm not saying all of it has. I don't want to be too negative. But I do think a lot of the themes in your book are weirdly relevant to a period of time that we're either, I think, still going through, feeling like, what are we doing right now? Why do we do the things we do? But also people feeling like they can't always connect with others right now. And that they're certainly we had some lockdown periods, right, where we all felt isolated. Does what I'm saying resonate with you in terms of why the book feels particularly relevant to the time we're in?
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. It's funny because, you know, I started it before the pandemic and everything.
So no, I know. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Everybody's going to take out different things. And like when I was first starting to draw it is when like Me Too was happening. And so we were like, oh, maybe this will be like wrapped up in that. But now that's over. So
yes.
So it's going to be different for everybody. But I think that issues of social isolation and loneliness and things like that and how we behave towards each other are always going to be relevant. Yeah. It's just that they're extremely heightened over there because of the remove from society and the imbalance that existed in the camps and does exist in camps. And so it was a very in your face, sort of all the time, the effects of removal from society. And loneliness.
Yeah, you alluded to the fact that you think Me Too is over. Do you think that the story?
Well, that's like the Twitter saying that. I don't know.
Yeah, no, there is a sense that we aren't. That some of these.
That we blew it up somehow.
Well, there's a sense that some of these very important social movements are just some weird viral thing that we can consume and dismiss. Even though they're like super important, right? Where I was coming from though is, do you though feel like some of the issues that you are discussing in the context of 2005, 2008 in Ducks, do you feel like consciousness about such issues, like the problems, I mean, are more heightened now than they were at the time?
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Yeah.
Cause we do talk about things like, mental health among like male workers and things like that, which we never talked about before.
Yeah.
Like that, like you would never find anybody talking about how's everybody doing out there. Like it's not, I feel like it wouldn't be a question that would be entertained. And yet now there is a documentary on CBC Gem called Digging in the Dirt about that very thing, which was from 2019. And so, you know, we are having these more of these conversations, and Me Too did like bring more women's stories out, especially like things that happen in a work environment or a place, not especially, but it did bring out those stories. It brought out lots of things that made it normal to talk about more normal than it had in the past. Although I got to say, there weren't that many working class women stories in there, were there, that no. were passed around. So
no, and
never made it that far.
Strikingly, like, and again, I'm trying to be mindful of not ruining the book for anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Strikingly, there is a Me Too thread in this book among women talking about sexual harassment and sexual assault. And it's framed to me in a sort of, it shouldn't be shocking. It's not shocking to me anymore. I was going to say shockingly matter of factly, just this, any women who interact will have a story like this.
And I only wrote down, or I put in what happened. And to everyone's credit, I asked the different people in the story who had something to that I was going to sort of dig into a little bit. I asked everyone, and they said it was all right to put it in there. So I thought that was very generous. So it's really not just me. Although, you know, I put my story in there, but it's no good to think of things as like an isolated incident, because there's never isolated incidents.
No, there aren't. And that comes through in this book. And it's, again, it's obviously very tragic. Did doing this help you in any particular way in processing all of this shit?
Probably. Yeah. It's been many years of working on it. So, I mean, yes, it did. I'm sure it did.
Okay.
It's a gradual process, right?
It's an interesting thing in this context, because I'm trying to be mindful of not prying. And yet, this is based on what you're saying in terms of checking in with figures who are depicted in this book. It's fair to say that you've tried to be as factual and truthful. This is a real story. All of this is as real as it possibly could be. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, people gave me permission to use their names, but we changed them. But I got in touch with the people that I could get in touch with. I even got in touch with some of the people that I had never met before. Like, there is somebody who, like, I read a news article where somebody dies in a car crash. I had to call that person's brother, and I never knew this person. So I got in touch with them because, you know, just be like, listen, I'm making this. It's a weird phone call to get. I'm making this book. I'm making this comic book. Do you mind? Not do you mind, but more like, you know, I want to let you know that I'm doing this. But I changed the name in there too. But then I had, you know, a conversation with this person's brother, and I don't know. You're making a story that's your story, but it's other people's too. It's not. Nobody wants to be surprised by opening up a book and being like, "Wait, that's me."
No, of course.
You know.
Yeah.
So I put on my Facebook and stuff. You know, I'm working on this book, and people are on my Facebook, so they know that it's there. The ones that are. I didn't really have a lot of contacts for the people in the very beginning of the book because we weren't all on social media.
Yeah.
So that the people that I could contact, I tried to.
So on that note, you've heard from some people in terms of permission. I know those of us who create things in the background and know they're going to be public somewhere around release day or the eve of release day, you get that little bit of trepidation juice
flowing through your
Have you heard much from other people depicted in this book, or what are you concerned about? Because we should say a couple things. I hope we haven't presented this as a completely dour story. This is really a story about communities developing under weird and strange circumstances as much as it is about the hardships of isolation and loneliness and what drives people to take on such things, economically or otherwise.
Almost nobody in interviews and stuff brings up the times when people were kind to me, which there are several through the book that made a big difference.
That's what I was getting at. I wanted to say that. Like, I do feel like there is a warmth that emanates from this book because you appreciate those, or the way you depict them anyway. It seems like you do appreciate the community building that was going on. Is that fair?
Yeah. I gave copies to... you remember the guy I went to Thanksgiving at their house? I gave a copy to him.
Yeah.
He's happy to get that. But I told him that he was going to be in it, and he and his wife. So he was home for the summer. I gave him a copy. I gave a copy to the other fellow from Cape Breton who shows up at my tool crib. And then later on, like in an airport and other places. Yep. So he has a copy. I mailed one to, he's my old boss, Ryan, in the book.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is he, is he doing okay?
Yes.
Sorry, yeah, I don't want to ruin the action of the book, but Ryan,
that's all right.
Ryan kind of leaves us and we don't really know what's going on. He's all right.
That's intentional.
Yeah.
Because that always happened there. And it was, you'd be worried about somebody and be like, this person's not okay. And then they would just be gone because they lost their job or they quit or whatever happened. And because those communities are out there on the periphery, no one knows. Like nobody knows. They just go back to their home wherever that is.
Yeah.
And they don't come into work the next day. And you're just like, and they take their problems with them. So the oil companies, you know, they're like Pontius Pilate.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I wash my hands. Mm-hmm. Wash my hands of this. No problems here, baby. All smooth. Smooth sailing over here. Never mind all these workers that go home and like, you know, in really bad shape. But no, Ryan was very generous to let me. He's one of those people that I talk to about. I was like, I would love to relate this because I think people need to understand the position that people like you are in. Which you will find out when you buy the book and
you should buy the book, Ducks. That's a thing. Before we wrap up here. Go ahead. You were going
to
say something.
I forgot. I just sent some in the mail to, they're Mike and Brian in the book.
Okay.
I just sent them in the mail yesterday.
So the trepidation
and Emily has one.
Right.
I'm trying to remember like the names that I gave to people. So I'm like, I have some copies now and I'm mailing them out and people are getting them. Don't worry.
So unlike the trepidation you might get for the general public receiving it, your trepidation is more about the people in the book receiving it and wondering what they think.
Well, you know, they're a pretty primary concern I'm mostly concerned that they don't find that it's like some kind of work of fiction or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I want what's in there to ring true. It's not their story. And if they were to write a book, of course, it'd be totally different and they would choose different scenes, but it's my book. And as long as they feel like the thing reads true, then that makes me feel good about it. But, so far, so good. And then, to the wider audience, you know, it's like the eve of publication pretty much. And some people are getting it like pre-orders already.
Yeah.
And, I'm quite nervous. I don't really know what to expect. I don't know.
Well,
I'm sort of holding my breath.
Yeah. Well, it is different for those of us who know. Here, I'm going to pull out another book. I'm going to pull out this book that I'm very familiar with because I used to read it to my children, my daughter in particular, Princess and the Pony. Now, I just want to say something real quick about the pony because the pony, those of us who know Hark a Vagrant and know this, this book, The Princess and the Pony, know this pony. It's an odd, I don't mean to insult you. It's kind of an odd looking pony.
It is.
It's always been an odd looking pony. There's a little Easter egg for those reading, those who know your work, Kate. Right? We might actually get a little bit of a glimpse at the origin story of the pony if we're reading Ducks. Can we leave it at that? Is that a fair thing to say?
That's totally fair. That's where I first drew it. So
it's a remarkable.
So we had to put that in the book. It's so
you
random.
Had to put it in the book. I like the notion that this is a character, rather, you at this time in your life are going through this financial and socio-cultural ordeal, and yet you haven't taken your eyes off the prize.
Yeah.
That the person you're going to become is the glimmer is there. So it's not a prequel, but it's close. It is for those of us who know you from who you are now. We get a little prequel of where did Kate come from? And I assume this has got to be the most autobiographical thing on some level that you've... is that a fair way of putting it?
I would say yes.
Yeah, I'm just making sure because I think there's autobiography in everyone's expression.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's autobiography in The Princess and the Pony somehow, a little bit.
I don't have any horses, but yeah.
Yeah, but you like farts?
Sure, who doesn't? Very funny.
Kate, what's next for you? And can you talk a little bit about that? This is such a huge project. Do you have future plans?
I am working on a couple things. I do have another picture book contract, and I am working on like some drafts of fiction comics, but they still are very regional over here. So if you read Ducks, you'll be like, I want more sad Cape Breton things. I'll be like, I'm coming right up, baby.
That's great.
Perfect.
What a joy that will be. No, that sounds great.
No, we'll put some jokes in there.
Okay, good. And is that's your main work at the moment?
Yes, and I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and the 1-year-old is not able to get into daycare for another few months, so we are burning the candle at both ends, pretty much. So,
well, I wish you the best of luck with all of those things, and I know what that can be like a little bit as a proud owner of an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old.
Oh boy,
I know what you're kind of going through. If people want to learn more about you on the internet or social media and about Ducks, do you know where you'd like to send people?
Well, I mean, I have a Twitter account, but Twitter's kind of like a garbage can these days, isn't it? So
no, it's I don't mind the Twitter. I still find some amusement there.
I do too, but then like some days you go on and you're like,
no,
I can't,
but that's true of all
tonight.
Social media. I think that's true of all of them.
Yeah. I suppose. Well, then my Twitter is BEATONNA.
And that's your main thing? Do you got a website and stuff?
No, I don't.
That's bonkers. Okay. Okay, well, the book, if I take a look here, is it's out on Drawn and Quarterly, right?
Yes, and you can find, they have a website, so.
Yeah, where the heck is it? I can't find the website thing.
Just Google Drawn and Quarterly and you'll
Google
find
Drawn
it.
And Quarterly. They very, very thoughtfully did not include a horrible looking website domain in any of the art of the book.
That's perfect. That's
in the jacket or anything. That's amazing. You don't see that anymore. So, okay, there you go. Drawn and Quarterly.
They assume people can Google, and so do I.
I know. I just like to ask, because some people say interesting things at the end of like, I hate such and such platform, but I love this one. And I hate my website. I lost the password to my website. I hate websites. I hear all sorts of things here, and I find it interesting.
Oh, yeah. I just shit at website making and everything. So I have a Patreon.
Oh, there you go. What's
I guess
that?
That's kind of like a website.
Yeah.
It's it's Kate Beaton, like making comics on Patreon.
Oh man. People should support that. That sounds good.
Oh, sure.
All right. I'm sorry.
You know what the funny thing is? I'm not very good at like this, like comics as a career. Like if I didn't have an agent, I would be living in a barrel. Because I'm shit at this.
No, you did fine. And I'll hyperlink all the things when I send things out so people know where to go. All right. The book is Ducks, 2 Years in the Oil Sands by the wonderful Kate Beaton. Kate, this was such a thrill for me to have you on the show. Thank you for making time for me. I hope you enjoyed yourself in some small way. And I wish you the best of luck in the future.
In some small way, I think I did.
So. Oh, my God. That's it? That's all I got?
That's all you sass for. So, I very much enjoyed talking to you. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, very special thanks again to Kate Beaton for appearing on this, the 716th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter @vishcreative, or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Vishkana. Also, visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast running. Now, $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content, audio stuff, interviews I've done with other people outside of this show in my past, and sometimes in my present, when they say, oh, we don't want to be on a podcast, we're too famous for that, we just want you to write an article. And I say, oh, fine. But then I take the recordings and I put them up on my Patreon, and ha ha ha, now I've got extra content. Why do I sound so nefarious? I don't know, it's Halloween coming up, I got evil, I'm sorry. Anyway, I do that, and I also put up episodes of the show early now on the Patreon. And, oh, if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on the Patreon, and I'll get you one. If I have any left, I still have some left. And, yeah, $6 or more a month gets you all that cool stuff. Anything less than that is really greatly appreciated, too. You can also go up and down. If you come into some dough, and you're like, I want to give Visha $300 a month. Or, things are a little lean, I have to go from 6 to 3 or 4. Whatever. That's the beauty of the thing. I just appreciate the support. It makes it feel like I'm not just doing this work for no reason, beyond the fact that I get a lot of good feelings from doing it and contributing to the culture and my society. What? I don't know why I'm telling you all my thoughts and feelings. Patreon.com/creativecontrol for more info about how to do that stuff I just said, which is supporting me and the show. Thanks again to the fine Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music in Alberta. You can learn more about them at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, who are each respectively located in Guelph, Ontario, and also Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for the show. Always great love to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Katie Beaton. I hope you enjoyed our chat. It was really a nice thrill and enjoyable for me to get to speak to Kate and have her on the show. And this book, Ducks, all her work's remarkable. The Ducks is really something else, so I hope you are intrigued enough to track it down. Links in the podcast stuff there. So thank you for supporting Kate and for supporting me and this show and telling your friends about it by subscribing to the show or following the show. And I will talk to you very soon. Thanks again. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.